somebody we've had on the program previously, Colin Delaney of ePolitics.com. We've got a link to ePolitics.com when you click on his name. Also, the ebook that has just been made available through ePolitics.com. That sort of makes him an ebook brother since we just released ours here. So good to have him on the program. I believe we're going to be joined by Joe DiGuardi momentarily here. But Colin, welcome to the program tonight. Good to have you back.
Hey guys, I'm just here to talk Eagles football.
Hey, big game this weekend.
Listen, I'm looking forward to it. I know all my Texas brethren are not going to be happy for me, but I defected about 15 years ago, and I wear the green now and not the blue and gray. So I'm looking forward to Sunday. It's going to be a game, definitely.
Be honest, Colin, you've got a green man outfit at home, don't you?
Well, you know, I've never thrown snowballs at Santa Claus, but maybe one day.
I just love watching Philly sporting events now and seeing, like, the faux green men in the stands. That is the greatest thing ever. That is just outstanding. But, I was rooting actually pretty hard for the Phillies in the World Series. Through this show, we've probably got more tie-ins to the Philadelphia Phillies than any other franchise in sports. We've had on the Fanatic. We've had on some other people from the media and the organization. We're pretty well tied into them, and I hate the Yankees. They're the team I hate more than anybody else. So, man, that just really sucked.
Well, man, it's a hard year sometimes. You know, 2009 was a rough year in a lot of ways. I'm hoping for a much better 2010, I'll tell you that.
All right, well, we'll do that. And I'll tell you what, let me take advantage of the time here, the fact that we don't have Joe DiGuardi with us on yet, to hit something you and I touched upon previously here, your last time on the program. You were on with us right about end of August, beginning of September. We were starting to preview the beginning of the fall election cycle. And, of course, the first year of a presidential administration, not particularly a busy cycle. I mean, you've got the Virginia governor's race. You've got New Jersey, some scattered other stuff. But we were talking about that and just kind of like looking ahead generally. And at that point in time, we had Afghanistan, which was kind of sitting there. I don't remember in terms of the chronology if that was after General McChrystal had gone public with his wishes or not. I think he'd put it out there, but we were talking about that at the time.
It was right around then, yeah. It was something that was moving at the time.
Yeah, I mean, starting to. First and foremost, I don't think either one of us at the time, although we had different, you know, thoughts on the subject, I'm not sure, A, either one of us would have thought it would have taken as long to get a final decision, but B, I gotta say this, and I know you probably won't agree, I gotta say I feel vindicated on my instincts from the time there, because, I come at this, as I've said before, I don't have a dog in the hunt here with the neocons or with Obama, although, you know, Obama can make even a paleocon like me sound like a neocon with some of his stuff sometimes, but it's one of these things where I swear to God, you know, this pacifistic strain in the Democratic Party here, I think that was what took the longest to get the thing done. I think it wasn't a matter of national security and what's the best thing to do. I think it's how do I do this without pissing off everybody that reads In These Times, you know? I mean,
I got to tell you the honest truth from everything I have ever read about Obama, and I'll tell you, I highly recommend David Plouffe's book, The Audacity to Win, if you have a chance.
Okay.
To read it. It's a great read. I mean, he actually doesn't talk politics very, I mean, of course, I mean, he clearly admires Barack Obama a great deal. You know what I mean? And so, you know, you may well take many of the things he says with a grain of salt, but if you want to look inside a successful political organization and what made it tick, man, you are not going to get a better book than that. I really seriously recommend it.
Well, and I want to get to the nuts and bolts and mechanics of this because I've talked about it with you before. You've written about the mechanics of how Obama won last year, and I remain very, very impressed by that on a purely strategic level of what was done. But as far as this went, I mean, every president has gaga that they put out there to get elected. And a
oh,
lot
sure, of,
it's
of course,
just
yeah.
Stupid stuff. George H.W. Bush, there will be no.
Well, I let me just say about Obama in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
If you listen to what Obama said during the campaign and actually listen to what he said and not what people imagined that he said, a lot of people, many of them on the right, but also many of them on the left, appear to have had imaginary conversations with Barack Obama in which he said plenty of extremely liberal things. But if you actually listen to what he said during the campaign, he's drawn down forces from Iraq and transferred forces to Afghanistan, and that's exactly what he ran on as a foreign policy.
Right.
I mean, the decision-making process, you know what? I'm glad he took a while. I mean, these are people's lives depending on this, right? An extra couple of weeks wouldn't hurt if it means that you get to have a few more voices in the room. You know, one of the things I respect about the guy is that he's not going to make a decision until he actually can feels like he can justify it to himself, and that takes a while in his case, and that's good.
Unless your troops out in the field, you know, waiting for some guy to finish playing his Hamlet act to send over reinforcements for you, I can see where they might get a little chapped in the ass.
Well, you know what? I imagine the forces in the field are more pissed off about low-grade bullshit that they have to deal with day-to-day than anything else. To be completely honest, I don't think it's a very good idea to put ideas in other people's heads unless they're here to represent themselves. I don't know what the troops are mad about. You know, I'm not going to presume to guess what they're mad about.
Yeah. Well, all right.
Because I'm not one.
Exactly. You know? Here's my thing. I agree with you on what Obama said during the campaign. I've never disputed that. What I've always disputed is whether that's something he said to get elected or something he believes. Everybody, George H.W. Bush, there will be no new net loss of wetlands. What a stupid thing to say. That just made the EPA more of a Gestapo than they were before. George W. Bush, buying off old folks with Medicare prescription drug stuff. Great. Way to pile onto our national debt there, you fiscal conservative. All presidents do phony things to get elected. Obama also. I think he'd like to have this one back.
I just respectfully submit the idea that maybe we've gotten so used to politicians who say anything to get elected that when a guy is actually relatively straightforward, it's hard to believe. But I'll tell you, he campaign. All I can go on, I'm not going to presume to guess what's in another human being's head. I don't live in a Barack Obama's brain. I honestly don't care what his actual motivation is. But I'll tell you, he campaigned saying that he would draw down forces from Iraq and insert forces and expand the war in Afghanistan, functionally. He said Afghanistan was the thing that we should have been doing and we hadn't, which would naturally lead you to believe that we'd be doing more in Afghanistan. That's what he said he's going to do. That's what he said he was going to do, and now that's what he's doing. So that's pretty conclusive as far as I'm concerned.
Poor sweet Colin. I hope you stay idealistic like that your whole life.
Friend, I worked in Texas politics for 4 years.
Exactly,
there was very little idealistic in me.
here's the next quote I was going to give you, and I'm paraphrasing here, but we're going to put our negotiations on C-SPAN for everybody to say. So come on, man. Don't say that Obama didn't just say anything to get elected. He promised that there would be full transparency of negotiations for legislation on there. We're going to post stuff, 3 days, 5 days ahead of time, so the whole world can see it. No more of this shoving a bill through in the darkness of night.
You know, okay. I tell you, he probably, honestly, half meant it at the time. But everybody promises that kind of stuff, and that never happens. Legislation is sausage making.
If he knew Lehman Brothers was going to go down in mid-September, he wouldn't have said half the stuff because he would have realized, all I got to do is stand here with my mouth shut, and I win in a solid.
I think you're imposing a paradigm on him. I think you're imposing an idea that, I mean, of course he's going to shade things one way or another, but I would suggest that of modern politicians, he's probably one of the least, if he's angered the left on anything, if he's gone back on his campaign promises on anything, I think actually I agree with you on the transparency thing. It's just I'm kind of cynical. I am really cynical when it comes to government transparency because I really do think that almost everything that you come up with is going to backfire in one way or another,
right.
Just practically in the actual day-to-day of government. But actually, it's on the things like Patriot Act, civil liberties-related stuff. That's where more people on the left are angrier at him than anything else.
I understand, but here's the whole thing on this again with the difference between a neocon and a paleocon and all of that. Me as a paleocon, I mean, I look at George W. Bush. I was queasy about Iraq when it started. I won't say I was full-blown opposed, but I was very, very queasy about it. As time went along, I clearly saw that, geez, if we had it to do all over again, we shouldn't have started this. That's where I come from. George Bush, though, I look at it, I fault what he did with what was in his mind. But my bottom line from what I see is in his mind, he got up every day thinking about, you know, and his worst fear was, man, what's going to happen to this country if we don't, you know, go out there and do stuff. I fault what he did with it, but I think that was his bottom line. I credit him for that. I look at Obama, and he knows better. He's a smart, smart, smart guy, although I've said before, I think he's more of an egghead than, like, real person smart. But he knows about the takeover of the Democratic Party since 1968 to 1972. He knows what's in the DNA. George Bush's biggest fear is what happens if this country gets hit. I think Barack Obama's biggest fear is, oh, my God, Katrina VandenHeuvel is going to call me a tool of the neocons.
Now, you know, honestly, I think you're grossly exaggerating the power of independent political voices.
Okay.
I really don't think Barack Obama cares a whole hell of a lot what somebody says about him.
Okay.
To be completely honest. I tell you, go read Pluff's book. You may well come away with a different impression of the guy. I always thought he was a very serious man. And that's how he's governing. It's a very serious man. And I don't have a problem with that.
Well, of course,
you know, the health care bill is a wreck. You know,
right.
It'll pass, but it's a wreck.
Right.
But, you know, that's what it takes to get something through a Senate where you need a 60% majority to do anything.
Exactly. But in my last point on this, because I want to talk about, you know, the budget stuff and everything with that. My last point, I'm using VandenHeuvel as one individual example of that. But
I don't even know who she is. Who is she?
She's the editor of The Nation. I was just throwing that out there.
Dude, 25,000 people read The Nation. Nobody cares what the Nation says. Nobody really cares what the liberal blogs say.
She's a fairly prominent talking head.
These things are trivial in the long term. Utterly trivial.
She's on CNN and MSNBC a lot as a talking head, so.
Great! A couple million people see her.
Right,
who cares? Reality matters so much more than those people.
I'm using her as the epitome, though, of what I see as the Daisy in a gun barrel DNA of that party and that wing and that movement. And I'm just using her as an example because I think he's got to be thinking in his head, even if we grant him everything that your purity of motives and everything you're saying, at the same point in time, he knows where his base is. Any politician, and this is as close as I'll come to giving him the benefit of the doubt, any politician is going to be somewhat hesitant at pissing off their base. And
Obama's base is 13 million people. Obama's base is 13.2 million people on his email list.
Okay.
His base is not the people who read liberal blogs. His base is not the people who read The Nation. It's the 13 million people on his list. It's his own supporters.
Okay.
They're who he's beholden to. And they knew what they were getting.
All right. Well,
a lot of the voices on the left that you're hearing from were not big fans of Barack Obama, you know, in 2007 either.
Right. Well, I'm gonna as we start to transition here, I'm gonna get into something where I think you're for the first time here tonight gonna feel comfortable fully embracing what I've got to say.
Great. We're gonna go back to the Eagles, aren't we?
Well, as a Browns and Dolphins fan, I don't have a dog in that hunt, you know.
Oh. Boy, man, you're a long-term sufferer.
I am indeed. But on this whole thing, as we look at, you know, whether it be the national budget, what we talked about the last time you were on with the stimulus package, which to date is the one major thing that Obama's gotten passed. The laundry list of major legislation has been rather thin to this point. That's the biggest one. By the way, I heard some Chris Matthews yesterday with another of his many inaccuracies. Hasn't raised taxes yet. What about the smokes tax? I think a lot of poor people could probably correct Chris Matthews on that.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. Yeah. And smoke and sin taxes are things that you can raise and get away with it. You know, I'm not actually a huge fan of taxes on smoking, but you and I can have that side conversation another day.
But I'll tell you what. See, here's the thing, though. With me, as a paleocon, as somebody who has, in terms of government, a lot of libertarian instincts, I've been saying this, and a lot of my Republican friends get PO'd at me because they feel like I'm the skunk at the garden party when I bring this point up. But it's a thing where I, honest to God, don't feel like the Republican Party can have a full revival just by being the anti-Obama. Like, if people hate this guy enough, they'll come back to us. People have to see that you got your, I'll make it PG-rated, stuff together, okay? People do not have short memories. People remember what it was like only a year ago, year and a half ago. They remember how bent they were about the war 3 and 4 years ago here. It's a thing where, and if it sounds a little convenient that I want the Republicans to sound a little more like the paleocons, then, hey, maybe guilty as charged. But it's a thing where I think they're, and I would be shocked if you disagreed with me. I think, you know, regardless of what you think on issue by issue, I think there has to be a cleansing and a sense that, like, wait a minute, you know, we don't agree with you voting us out, whatever, we'll never agree with that, but we get what made you do that. We get what made you turn away from us. If you put us back in, we're not the same worthless pricks as before. We got it together. It's going to be a better and a different show this time. I think that's what's got to happen as opposed to vote for
Obama. I don't know. Here, I'll tell you. I would point to two different things with the Republicans right now. And as somebody who was in high school as a Democrat and as a fairly liberal Democrat in East Texas in the 80s, mm-hmm. you know, where the Democratic Party was just collapsing all around you and, you know, your belief system was being pummeled in public all the time.
That's like
I had a high school friend of mine tell me that Walter Mondale was a communist. But I've been through tough times when a party is down for a long period of time. And looking at you guys, you have two distinct, well, any number, but I would like to point to two distinct problems. One is a human one that, man, you guys have a lack of talent. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm sure that there are, I mean, I know bright younger people in the Republican Party. I have quite a few friends who are Republican activists in town who are very, very sharp people. But at the office holder level, at the running for senior office level, you guys have a dearth of talent. There's just not much there. And then the second thing is this fight between, I don't know what you want to call them, the country club Republicans, the liberal Republicans, whatever, and then the Tea Partiers, but also the evangelicals who can often split with the Tea Partiers. You know, Tea Partier libertarians can be, you know, non-religious, where, you know, the evangelicals are definitely a different breed. Anyway, there's some serious divisions in there. Winning takes a ruling coalition always, right? I mean, we only have two parties, but, you know, the Democrats held power for a long time with a coalition of northern liberals and southern conservatives. You know, and the Republicans basically took over the Southern conservative angle of that in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And now the Republicans coalition has sort of evaporated. And it may take them a decade or two to work out of that hole. I mean, eventually Democrats will screw it up, no problem at all. I mean, there'll be an opening. But you guys have got to get a deeper bench, and you've got to assemble an actual coalition that can win national elections.
I understand that. I'm not quite as bearish on the Republican prospects just because I feel like with the kind of year the Democrats have had, the Republicans have gained a lot by default. I think that what was said at the beginning of the year by a lot of people tends, you know, was ignorant of the fact that things move so much faster these days. You know,
can I ask you a quick question? Which was the last president to have the same approval rating as Barack Obama at the same point in his presidency?
I've been hearing comparisons to Jimmy Carter at this point.
Ronald Reagan! Okay. If you recall, there was a recession on at the end of his first year as president, and you know they had dropped, raised interest rates dramatically. I mean, it was a recession they almost had to have in order to kill runaway inflation back then, but it was very painful at the time. Right. Ronald Reagan's approval level was below 50%,
right,
just like Barack Obama's is right now.
No, that's true. That's true. But,
I mean, all I'm trying to say is that 2010 is going to be a very different year than 2009. The healthcare bill is going to pass, flawed as it is. They'll very quickly move on and they'll pass a jobs bill, I'm sure. That'll make everybody happy. The economy is slowly picking up on its own, way too slowly. But by the time the actual election runs around, you know, things are going to be at least moderately back on course. Dems will lose some seats, but it's not going to be a massacre.
Well, you may be a little bit of an outlier from what I'm seeing here, because the only question that there seems to be from what I'm seeing these days is, and not a lot of people are giving the Republicans a chance of taking it back outright, but the only real question seems to be how close do the Republicans come. You would disagree with that premise then?
Well, I mean, I think it's just meaningless in a time of great change economically. I mean, my God, only like, 40% of the stimulus money has actually been spent. Mm-hmm. A lot of the long-term money is just going out. I have actually friends, a couple of friends of mine who are scientists of the National Institute of Standards and Technology who had to work really hard this fall to review projects to get money out the door. It's just going out the door now. Okay. They're a great example of that. I mean, the stimulus money is going to keep going into the economy. You have to be actually a little careful about not overstimulating the economy and starting another bubble of some kind. It's just a year is a long time in politics. I mean, my God, the primaries, most of the primaries aren't even until this summer. So it's kind of meaningless to even guess. As soon as health care passes, it'll be popular. You know, that'll change things right away. I mean, I bet Obama's popularity, his approval rating is going to be, 55-60% by midsummer.
Healthcare doesn't actually kick in, though, till like 2013. Or there may be a few things that kick in before then.
Yeah, there'll be a couple little things. Well, not little things. There are a couple of things that are relatively easy to do that have to do with, like, pre-existing conditions and stuff like that. But, no, it's just that once the nastiness is over, because, I mean, watching a legislation get made is, that whole, you don't want to watch, there are two things you don't want to watch get made, right? Laws and sausage. It's a very ugly process. Once that's over, all people will see is, hey, they passed a health care bill.
Well, exactly.
It's going to be a positive.
Well, and I will tell you what, too, and I've been saying this all along, one of the areas where the Democrats are at a disadvantage, in a sense, getting to 60 in the Senate was almost a bad thing, because it's a thing I've been saying all along, and hey, when the shoe was on the other foot and the Republicans were in charge and the a-hole moderates in the Republican Party were, calling the shots, that's when I was unhappy. But I've been waiting for this, saying, you know what? A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So go ask
anybody
out there in the liberal blogosphere what they think of Ben Nelson these days, or Joe Lieberman, or anybody else. Here, you got the worst of both worlds, Colin. 60 votes, which the public thinks, OMG, 60. You can get anything done with 60, but you can't.
But I'll tell you, somebody, how crude are we allowed to be on the radio? somebody always has you grabbed at a vital spot in politics.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Somebody's got you. There's always a vote, unless the odds are so on your side, it's not even funny. I mean, politics is all about wielding very small edges of power to get people to do things that you would like them to do. Mm-hmm. Somebody's always got you. So you always have to compromise in ugly ways. That's just what happens.
That's true. That's true. And that's what it takes to get these things done here. I want to talk about your e-book that you've got here, How Candidates Used the Internet to Win in 2010. You had a previous e-book out about how Obama got elected. And I suspect that there's a lot of overlap in here when you're talking about these technological progressions and stuff. Something that I found very surprising in the course of putting together the FDH Lounge ebook that we did, looking at all different topics from the last decade going ahead to the next decade. We've got a 5-page conversation in there that I conducted with two friends of mine that are political consultants, both of them Republicans. Both of them disagreed with your premise, which I happen to agree with, by the way. They were basically saying, hey, Obama could have done it just with Ross Perot's 800 number. Obama was the right man at the right place at the right time, charisma, everything like that. I keep pointing out to them and saying, look, Bobby Kennedy had a lot of advantages and stuff too. He couldn't beat the machine. For Obama, winning in the fall was pretty much the easy part in that climate. Hillary Clinton,
I agree with you.
You're not going to topple a quasi-incumbent without the technology. I disagree with their premise so strongly.
Well, are these guys traditional TV-era politics guys?
They do a lot of modern stuff, but I think their perspective is dated. They came of age before some of this stuff hit, and I think it's a pre, end of the 2000s mentality.
Yeah, I think that they didn't watch, they weren't in the Obama campaign, so they probably don't know what happened. I would suggest that they go read David Plouffe's book. I wrote on my site, I did an Internet Politics Index to his book. I basically noted down every mention of the Internet in politics just because I was really curious, and I knew I'd use it as a resource later on. And the Internet as a key tool comes up about every third or fourth page. So Obama's campaign manager certainly thought that the technology. I actually asked him flat out. I was on a conference call with him. They were when he was promoting his book. The PR firm, you know, did a political blogger call. So I got to ask him a couple of questions, and I flat out asked him, you know, if there weren't an internet, would Barack Obama have been president? I could not quite get him to say yes. I couldn't quite get him to agree with me. But if you read his book, the first thing that they, you know, their first priority was getting the online thing right.
Ironically, too, you know, both of these guys, I mean, as you would expect, you know, fairly anti-Obama because they're Republican operatives, but I would think it's almost easier to give credit to the technology than to say he won on the issues or because he was so right on a lot of that stuff. So, you know, that's...
Well, but the technology did was put to work the spare time of people who were motivated.
Right.
Right? And what motivated him was his personality and his policies.
Right. That's definitely true here. What I want to do, and we got the Congressman Joe DeGuardia on line one. We'll get to him here in a second. I know you've got to go, Colin. I want to give you a chance to promote this e-book, anything you got going on any politics. Get it all out here.
Oh, great, man. Thanks. No, I have I put out a publication. It's about 30 pages. It's a guide to using the internet to win elections in 2010. I'm not going to promise that you know, the internet's going to win it for everybody. But these are off your elections, you know, and turnout's going to be relatively low. So mobilizing a few hundred people here and a few hundred people there might make all the difference in a tight race. And also the internet is great for fundraising. So I have a free publication out. Just go to epolitics.com, pull it down, take a look, see what you think.
Okay, yeah, excellent. And I believe here also, and I'm just scanning around here, I believe it's also relatively easy to find on ePolitics your previous Barack Obama 2008 campaign ebook?
Absolutely. And that one's now, the new book has been pulled down, has been downloaded directly from the site about 1,000 times now. The Obama book is closing in on 10,000 downloads.
Right.
So it's free, but selling like hotcakes.
All right. Well, that's what you want. You want to move it. You want to get it in front of eyeballs and everything. And Colin, it was a lot of fun as always, and I look forward as 2010 goes by having you back on, and you and I can chew over this stuff some more.
Excellent. Keeping me honest, man. My own worst enemy is my own words. You know.
All right. Keep calling me on my stuff too. All right. Thanks, Colin. Have a great 2010. We'll have you back on soon.
Thanks, man. Talk to you later.
Appreciate it, Colin Delaney from ePolitics. I knew it was going to be fun sparring with him. As it generally is. So what was to be a round table is now going to be mano-a-mano and then mano-a-mano again here. Our next guest coming up on the program here, we have information and we have copious links up about this gentleman here on our rundown here tonight. The first practicing CPA ever elected to Congress, Joseph DeGuardia. He is, as we said on there, one of the few people who can really get his arms around, probably just how, not to be pessimistic, but really how screwed we are as a country, how this burgeoning debt that we keep accumulating keeps screwing us over. We don't have a good read of what's on the books. Essentially, you know, this is not going to be happy talk, but this is going to be real talk. We always keep it real in the FDH Lounge, and this gentleman can help us do that. A man elected to Congress in
Thank you,
New
Rick.
York in the 1980s, Joseph.
Are you there? I heard that great introduction.
Thank you for coming on, sir. Good to have you on the show.
Hey, listen, you know, I do a weekly TV show, and I was in the studio, and I had my mobile phone off, and I saw all the calls your studio called me. Thank God I got here in time to get on. Thank you for having me, Rick.
Oh,
shoot.
Sure.
What are your questions?
Good
I'm
to
ready
you.
To answer anything.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Let me put over the excellent job of Ryan Isley across the glass here. His hard work and diligence in tracking you down. Essentially, and you and I talked a little bit off air here about the situation. You have previous experience with government bailouts, with what happened with New York City in the 1970s, being hands-on with that. In your book, you wrote about the SNL bailout at the end of the 1980s. So
right.
I would start by just saying, if you could, talk about what you wrote and observed at the time and compare it to now when we've just got these super burgeoning bailouts and spending going on.
Well, Rick, that's a good place to start. And how did I get involved in that? I joined Arthur Andersen in 62, and by 1972, I was a partner in the firm. And in 1975, the firm was hired by the Treasury Department to work with Felix Rohatyn in order to come up with some kind of a bailout formula. You remember what Ford said, New York City dropped dead. That was the front page of the Daily News. No one thought the bailout would go through, but we managed as a firm to get partners together that could piece together the financial statements of a very complicated entity called New York City. Their accounting was atrocious, but we managed to do it. And based on that, and based on a strategy that was agreed to by the investment bankers, you remember the Big Mac bonds that were put there to bail out the city? It happened. Well, after that, in 75, the person who ran the firm at that time, Harvey Kapnick, said, you know, we've gotten so much good experience with this team of partners from around the country to understand this dumb government accounting and convert it to something that people could understand on Wall Street so that there was something to bail out. Why don't we go forward as a firm and spend the next year trying to piece together the financial statements of the United States of America? What a, you know, thinking outside the box. It took 2 years. I was part of that team, and we did something that ended up being called a prototype statement, the Consolidated Financial Statements of the United States of America. Arthur Andersen, being a publicly spirited company at the time, did it for no money for 5 years. But in the early 80s, they passed it on to the Treasury Department, who decided that, you know, we should probably prepare these statements because we run the government on a cash basis, and we could be criticized for not understanding what liabilities we're putting on to the future, including Social Security. So back in the early 80s, I believe it was 82, the Treasury Secretary took it upon himself to put out this statement from the United States to be signed by the Comptroller General, the guy who runs the Government Accountability Office, as it's called today, and himself. Well, you know what? It wasn't a year after they got it, they took Social Security off the balance sheet as a liability. And came up with some cockamamie thing that said, well, the law says that if we run out of money, we have no obligation to pay it. But wait a minute. We had politicians getting elected on this being called a trust fund and a lockbox. So, you know, what are we talking about here? They got votes because they said they were going to protect it. The way Gore was swearing he'd protect that lockbox, nobody would touch it. But what he didn't say is, back in 1967, Lyndon Baines Johnson passed something called the Unified Budget because he wanted to disguise the cost of the Vietnam War. He saw all this money sitting in the Social Security Trust Fund surpluses, because don't forget, Rick, in those days, we had a lot more people working than retiring. So we were building up surpluses. We're still building up some surpluses today, but with the baby boomers, they're going to disappear soon. But what he did is he offset the surpluses in Social Security. Medicare wasn't there then, but they're doing that today. Social Security and Medicare is being offset, the surpluses, against the deficits in the rest of government. So when they report to the people, they're reporting the net, which is not the way you have full disclosure. If you're a CPA, one of the most important things in your profession is full disclosure, objectivity, fairness, and transparency. We have none of that in the United States of America. Read my book, Unaccountable Congress. I wrote it 17 years ago, and I'm the first one to forecast in Chapter 4, which I entitled The Big Apple and Washington, One Bailout After Another. I said, if we follow what New York City was doing, someone's going to have to bail us out. But who's going to do it? In those days, we were worried about China. I mean, Japan. Now we're worried about China because we're spending money we don't have and we're borrowing from people who don't share our values. We are putting this country in great jeopardy because it's never going to be sustainable if we keep spending people money we don't have and borrowing from people we don't trust.
Absolutely right. We've got links up on our rundown here tonight for anybody that wants to go buy the book. Unfortunately, we're a little short on time tonight because we started this late with you, but I do want to ask you also in terms of this, in terms of something very contemporary, Ron Paul in Congress, who I know that you're sympathetic with on a
great one of my friends, yes.
Yes,
a libertarian. Go ahead.
Exactly. 300 co-sponsors on his bill to audit the Fed. I like you to assuage the fears if you can of folks like myself, because I'm right with you on this stuff. I believe that it needs to be done. Having said that, fearing that the emperor has no clothes, I'm afraid you do that audit and we see what a house of cards this entire system is, and everything
right.
collapses like we were afraid of last year. Can you set straight people like me that are terrified that an audit of the Fed could bring everything down by revealing that the emperor's got no clothes?
Well, but you know what? We need to know what's going on. Why should we fear information? Why should we fear the truth? Why should we fear needing to know what's going on so we can plan for the future? We can't put our heads in the sand. In fact, I would go a step further than Ron Paul. I would ask for outside auditors. He didn't do that in his bill. He's asking for an audit by maybe the Government Accounting Office or the U.S. Treasury Department. Who knows? We got all kinds of auditors in the federal government. No. I would go two steps further than Ron Paul, and I did this in a rally to support him in front of City Hall, Manhattan, a couple of months ago, where they had the Audit the Fed rally. And I said, not only should we audit the Fed, we should have outside auditors audit the Fed. And number two, not only should we audit the Fed, we should audit everything in government. We don't have outside audits, so we really can't trust the numbers. And that's a big problem right now. If we're going to protect shareholders by having SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission type accounting, which is based on generally accepted accounting principles, putting both assets and liabilities on the books, intergenerational fairness, so you don't pass bills to the next generation without them knowing it. Why are we doing that to protect the shareholders of publicly traded companies and not the taxpayers of America? Do you have to be an accountant to understand that that makes common sense?
Well, good points. Good points. You know, common sense and common sense is, again, what shines through in your book as I read it there and everything. And I would just like to say, you know, Congressman, as somebody who's dabbled in politics, for most politicians, I just have a lot of, for both parties, I have a lot of distaste.
So do I.
Say that. I appreciate that. I want to put you over. I think you are the rare breed who ran for office for the right reasons. You ran in very tough terrain in New York. It's very tough to stand for the things that you stood for.
Hey, Rick, I ran to take Dick Ottinger's seat in 1984.
Yeah.
That was the most liberal Democratic district you could think of,
yeah.
And I was a Republican. And no one gave me any chance. But I put both of my immigrant parents on my arms and walked through all those ethnic neighborhoods in Yonkers, in New Rochelle. And I became a congressman by a few votes, but no one thought I had any chance. You got to present yourself to the people. People are smart. Once they see that you're not just a slogan-type person, they forget your party.
Right.
They say, you know what? Here's a guy, worked his way through college as a waiter. Parents are immigrants. They had a grocery store in the Bronx with vegetables and whatnot. I used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to help my father load the truck. We moved to Westchester when he could afford to buy a house. And by the way, Rick, he didn't get a mortgage. He took the money out of the bank to buy the house.
That's
in 1957. I never forget it. Today, we're giving people mortgages, and they don't have jobs. I mean, look at where we've come in America, and we want to know why this country is no longer sustainable. Why the next 10 years might turn us, Lord knows where. Maybe the currency. Well, you know, right now the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency. There are people saying we should change it because we can't trust America anymore. Because we're spending too much. Moody's is saying maybe we're going to drop next year the rating on Treasury bills. Can you imagine this? The great United States of America is now being put to these ridiculous tests because we refuse to audit ourselves. We refuse to be truthful to ourselves. And you know what? We need a few more accountants in the legislative branch of government. That's the problem.
Absolutely. And you know what? And ironically, I think one of the most admirable things anybody could say about you is in looking at this and saying that ultimately somebody with your positions proved to be unsustainable as far as keeping that seat, but you never trimmed your sails. I think you are the epitome, I think, of somebody that runs for office for the right reasons, commits to principles, sticks with them. If they're unpopular, to hell with it. You've got that. You're still out there educating the people, and we just appreciate the job that you're
Rick,
doing.
I carried on my congressional agenda after leaving Congress in 1989 with two foundations, one public, one private, and a civic league volunteer lobby for the Albanian people and their rights. My wife and I created a new state called Kosovo. It took 20 years. and we have also a political action committee. So we believe in citizen empowerment. You don't need a title to do good.
You do not. That is true. And, you know, we appreciated having you on. I would love to have you back for, you know, another discussion of matters as we go into 2010.
Please do. I'm an expert in healthcare. I want to tell you what's wrong with both bills and how we have to go back to prevention.
Okay.
The issue is human behavior. We're not training people on how to stay healthy. And that's why we have the government now trying to take over responsibility for keeping us healthy. And it's going to cost us a fortune.
That's true. That's very true. We'll talk about that with you, Congressman Joe DeGuardian. And may I say also, you are part of a very multi-talented family as well. Please give our best to your daughter as another season of American Idol is about to begin. And
hey, Rick, that little girl sang in all my campaigns back in the late 80s. In fact, when she was 12 years old, I had her singing at the Waldorf in front of 1,000 people when I was a chairman for the Italian-American Day, what was that, Columbus Day dinner with Sophia Loren, the chairman, or the grand marshal, and she brought the house down. Little did I know she'd become a great songwriter. But yes, Cara DioGuardi, the fourth judge on American Idol, soon to become the third judge. As you know, Ellen DeGeneres is coming on. It's going to start again on January 12th. I'm very proud of her. She's smart, and you're going to hear a lot more from her.
Awesome. Maybe we could get you both on here sometime for an appearance, sir. But it's good to have you on. We look forward to bringing you back on in the new year.
Sorry I wasn't there sooner, but call me anytime you want, Rick. I'll be on.
Thank you so much. Good stuff, Congressman. Congressman Joseph DeGuardi, everyone. We appreciate having him on, an expert on the issues. Again, somebody, it's good to talk to somebody who ran for office for the right reasons, stuck to his principles, got voted out, but is still promoting the stuff he ran for office to talk about in the first place. Good guy, knowledgeable guy. We you know, it's a blot on the Congress. We don't have more guys like him in there. And many thanks to the New York Bureau for getting him booked, as with our previous guest, Colin Delaney.